The U.S. Coast Guard helps protect the country's interests far beyond its own coast. In fact, it has ships operating throughout the world. One reason is its illegal drug trafficking interdiction mission, a mission that's growing and taking up more resources. In part one of my interview, Admiral Paul Zukunft, the Coast Guard Commandant, explains the international part of his job.
One of my collateral duties as the Commandant of the Coast Guard is I chair the Interdiction Committee, which is made up of principals from across the entire interagency, which is really designed of how do we synchronize whole of government within the United States to have the maximum effect against transnational criminal organizations, and in this case, those that are trafficking in illicit drugs. Well, it doesn't take a genius to realize that the United States can't do it alone, that we've got to bring on other partners, other allies. And so we went down to Ecuador because we have a new president down there, and President Moreno, and he has opened the door to the United States. What's caused the door to open is that Ecuador is now seeing a significant increase in cocaine consumption and with it violent crime, especially near the border between Ecuador and Colombia. So they have a problem. We then went to Colombia and we met with Vice President Naranjo, who's leading a interagency and joint task force to eradicate and try to stop the production of coca and ultimately producing cocaine in Colombia, but they have enormous challenges in front of them as well. Resource challenges and sometimes resources, law enforcement and challenging, especially when drugs enter the high seas, their limited ability to apprehend those. And then we met with President Varela in Panama. And President Varela views himself as somewhat of a firewall between South America and the United States. Last year, they apprehended record numbers of illegal migrants, some of these what we would call a special interest alien, trying to get to the United States, and yet they're stopping them in Panama. And then they're sending them back the other way. They're doing the same thing with drugs arriving in Panama. The consumption rate in Panama has remained flatlined, and they realize that most of these drugs are destined for transit through Central America, spawns violent crime, but ultimately for consumption here in the United States.
So it sounds like Panama takes more liberty with respect to returning people on the spot than even the United States is able to do legally.
We have a tremendous ally in Panama, absolutely.
All right, so what's the conclusion of all of this? I mean, where do we go from here?
So now it's time to really roll up our sleeves. So Ecuador said we want to do more combined operations with the United States. And when they say the United States at sea, what they mean is the United States Coast Guard. Colombia, meeting with the head of Colombian Navy, said we want to do even more work with the United States. And in Panama, we've done combined operations with all of these countries in the past. I'm optimistic of our relationship with Ecuador, and that's a key one. We used to have an operating base. We would have eight aircraft operating out of Manta, Ecuador. With the prior regime, we were basically shut down in 2010. That was probably one of our most effective bases in detecting drugs at sea.
Now, does Ecuador have a Navy and separate Coast Guard like the United States, or do they just have one waterborne service?
They have a Navy and they have a Coast Guard as well. Obviously, not to the magnitude of our Navy or our Coast Guard here in the United States.
And how did you find their training, their level of equipment readiness and modernization relative to what the Coast Guard has?
Well, we didn't get out to the field units, Tom. But that was one of the topics of discussion. They said, we would love to see the Coast Guard back. We would love to do training with the Coast Guard again. And so it's good to refresh that dialogue.
Because that must be pretty much of a stretch in terms of resources to train down there for the Coast Guard to project that far forward, I would imagine is kind of a stretch for you.
Well, believe it or not, it's not. Most people think Coast Guard, and on any given day, we are off the coast of all seven continents around the world. In that part of the world, between Colombia, Panama, and Ecuador, on any given day, we have six major Coast Guard ships. And many times, they'll call in these ports to refuel, to reprovision, and we can certainly do training when we're in those ports as well, because we're already off their coast.
We're speaking with Admiral Paul Zukunft, the Commandant of the Coast Guard, and this increase in interdiction emphasis, what has that meant for the staffing of the Coast Guard? I mean, you're not growing really right now.
Yeah. So when I came into this job a little over 3 years ago, Tom, the first thing I said, you know, we're going to have intel drive where we operate. Now, intel also drives where we're not operating. You don't have infinite resources, you're constrained, but we have information and we're staffed, we're members of the national intelligence community to have awareness of over 80% of the maritime drug flow that are on the waters in the Pacific and in the Caribbean. But back in 2014, on the best of days, we could maybe target 10% of that 80%. So it really just came down to where do you reprioritize your missions? And so we pulled from other mission areas and we applied more resources to address this threat. So last year, record removal of cocaine. This year, we're on pace to beat last year's record.
And so where have you pulled from?
Well, I probably don't want to say that, but you know, I just call it, you know, good operational risk management. But I probably don't want to divulge that. But the fact that people don't realize that I pulled from an area, to me, tells me that, you know, we made the right decision in terms of how do we effectively manage risk.
And how do you manage the relationship with, say, Customs and Border Protection and ICE and some of the other Homeland Security units that are really sisters to you within DHS that also are involved, because they send out a lot of press releases on drug interdiction?
Well, we could not have the success we had without our teammates in HSI or ICE and with CBP. And, you know, I don't want to leave DEA out of the picture as well. Huge team effort in terms of sharing information. Customs and Border Protection fly aircraft out of the same base that we fly out of down in El Salvador. Huge enablers in terms of detecting this flow. It's our ships that have the authorities to apprehend and interdict the vessels, but it really is a collective effort among everybody. But certainly great synergy within the Department of Homeland Security.
Now, has the shift in priorities or shift in where you operate also increased the tempo at which you're operating ships and other craft?
I wouldn't say it's increased. We're deployed just as many days as we have been in the past. But those days are much more action-packed than they have been in the past. I've spent many years at sea, and I would much rather be running at a fast pace, knowing that you are in the game. And again, because the information is so good, in years past, I would liken it to a tractor. You know, digging furrows back and forth, and then hopefully, you know, you stumble upon something on one of those passes. And that's kind of how we did this mission, you know, 12, 13 years ago. Well, now we know where the threat's at, and you are running at full speed to interdict it. We've taken most of the guesswork out of it. And so, you know, to be deployed, when you talk to these crews coming back, I mean, some of them, they're counting down the days till they can get back there and go again. I would like them going fishing, and it's a feeding frenzy, and you have to come in and you've got to fillet your fish, sell them. You can't wait to go back and catch some more. So this is kind of how our crews are operating today.
But what does that take a toll on the readiness or the ability to maintain the equipment? I mean, does it accelerate the aging of what's already an aged fleet? And also, does it affect the ability to, do you have enough people to rotate in and out of these high tempo operations?
Yeah. Well, Tom, our biggest challenge is I've got 50-year-old ships down there doing this mission right now. And the only way they're able to do it are the men and women who literally for generations have been maintaining these older ships. But we run into parts obsolescence. So if a system breaks, sometimes the part just isn't there. And so that takes them out of the mission. Our newer ships that are coming in, our national security cutters, our fast response cutters, we'll soon deliver our offshore patrol cutter. We'll take delivery of the first one in 2021. These are truly a quantum leap above their predecessors in terms of the capability that they bring.
And with respect to training, has the new emphasis, the new mission, or the emphasis on the mission that you've shifted to, has that affected how people are trained and how they're recruited even for the Coast Guard?
We haven't really changed our recruiting approach, and by that I mean, you know, we don't take anyone who has a GED. You better, at a minimum, have a high school diploma. Now, we've taken a few with GEDs because those folks had Bachelor of Science degrees. They went on and went to college. The quality and caliber of people entering the Coast Guard today in an all-volunteer service is at an all-time high. But they come into the service because they want to be involved. They want to contribute. And so this is an area where they can contribute. We continually update our training, and probably the most important one is our use of force training, especially when you look at the scrutiny applied to law enforcement in general, to make sure that we always use the minimal force necessary to compel compliance. It really goes back to Alexander Hamilton, the father of the Coast Guard, and he said, "Be mindful that we are a nation of free men and are intolerant of rude and haughty behavior." So we want to make sure that we are not rude and haughty in the conduct of carrying out our missions.
Because occasionally there's still the fishing out of the water of somebody who's a boat capsized. That's still something the Coast Guard, I guess, does occasionally. And you don't want to approach those people the way you approach the submerged carrier of 10 tons of cocaine.
No, and those are clearly distinct messages. With a search and rescue case, these folks want to be found. With drug smugglers, they do not want to be found.
And let's talk a little bit more about the new ships coming online. There have been some tough reports from GAO and the auditors with problems with those ships. Engines have failed in new models and had to be towed back. I guess the davits had a problem. Those have been fixed now with whatever technology is required. So what's your outlook for getting these on a regular build and delivery schedule with some reliability? And we'll talk about the budget separately, but right, just in terms of getting the ships, the product correct.
Yeah, actually we do have the product right. We have not had to tow any ship back when it was on patrol. The engines that we operate, it's called an MTU, but it's designed to operate at a high RPM. They don't do well idling. So it was a bit of a human learning curve for us. The older diesel plants that we had, you can run on one engine, run it at an idle speed, and you can run it indefinitely. With these, they bog down. You need to keep a load on it. We also found out that the most efficient speed for these ships to transit at is much faster than the older ships. So they're saving fuel, yet they get to the theater of operations much quicker. So part of it was on us. It was a learning curve. The davit systems, that was an easy fix, and so we're at the point now where a national security cutter on its maiden voyage literally pays for itself, if you will, and then usually 1.5 times over in the value of illicit drugs that it removes in one deployment. And these ships will be around for 30 plus years. The technology that goes into these ships, our ability to exploit and initiate intelligence on, you know, transnational criminal organizations is a huge game changer for us as well. And that's why you see these ships come back to San Diego or Cape Canaveral with an entire flight deck with pallet after pallet of cocaine just from one deployment. So they really have been a game changer. But we've been through this learning curve. And I could not be more pleased with the performance of these platforms.
And there must be an operational savings, drug interdiction aside. They use less fuel, they go faster, and they require less life cycle cost, at least at this point in their life cycle.
Correct? And that is correct, Tom, and we need to stay in front of that, which is why when I testify on the Hill, I talk about, you know, I need 5% growth in my operating base, because for 5 years running now, we find ourselves in our fifth consecutive year funded below the Budget Control Act. I'm a military service. And if you were to tell any one of my other service chief counterparts that you were going to be funded for the next 5 years below the Budget Control Act, yet you still have a job to do, some of that work would have to stop. And so the area where we start incurring some degree of risk is on the maintenance side. And once you get down that slippery slope, you may have to lay up or take a ship out of service. So it's a very delicate balance. But as a military service, we need to be funded like a military service. And so we do need that growth put back into our budget to at least keep pace with inflation, if nothing else.
We're speaking with Coast Guard Commandant Paul Zutkonft. And let's talk about some other types of vessels besides the national security cutters. You mentioned fast response cutter. What is the status of that program?
We just awarded phase two a little over a year ago to build out all 58 of these. The last five ships that came off the production line were delivered with zero discrepancies, which is a real testimony to the shipbuilder, Bollinger Shipyards, and then all the systems that go in them, L3 communications and others. But these are, again, quantum leaps above a 110-foot patrol boat that they replace. The weapon systems, the command and control systems that are on there, its seacaping capability, its speed, all of the above, tremendous, tremendous platforms.
And there was a third type of ship you mentioned.
So we awarded the offshore patrol cutter, which will be a light frigate, about 350 feet in length. And so Eastern Shipbuilding Group is the contractor to build the first nine of these. It's a program of 25 ships. And quite honestly, we cannot get these ships in the water soon enough. We will take delivery of the first one in 2021.
And let's talk about things that fly, because you're exploring the area of unmanned aircraft.
Now, we are long overdue to get into the world of land-based, long-range unmanned aerial platforms to operate in the maritime domain. We're doing that right now with ship-based systems that are quite stealthy, and they've been very effective, because in the past, you would see a big white ship and an orange helicopter arrive over the horizon. And maybe you have a ship that's waiting to refuel a go-fast. And we've had this exact scenario play out. And so one of these ships launched its unmanned aerial system. And they realized this is a refueling vessel. And so for 36 hours, they monitored this. And then once the go-fast showed up, they pulled back the unmanned system, launched the manned helicopter with an M240 machine gun with a 50 caliber sniper in the cockpit of this aircraft, and then disabled the go-fast. But they never knew we were there. And so, you know, several tons of cocaine removed just using more stealthy technology. But we need that for our surveillance. We don't have enough aircraft. You can put more ships on the water, but if you're not putting more air surveillance up there, you start to become ineffective. And so that's an area that we really need to move out on.
So the platforms exist that you could adapt for Coast Guard use. You just have to get the budget and the operational concept to use them.
Yeah, and so we've seen that, you know, a mark in this year's budget to start moving out in that direction, and we'll work within the Department of Homeland Security, look at what's already, you know, commercially available off the shelf. And it really comes down to what's the right sensor package that can operate in a maritime environment to expand our range. And this would not be based in the United States. We would push it downrange into the transit zone. When people think about protecting our borders really begin 1,500 miles and more beyond the United States. But all of this flow is destined here for, you know, when talking about drugs, you know, they want to get it here. But it doesn't arrive on our shoreline. It lands in Central America, but we need to stop it well south before it arrives here in the United States.
And anything else on the platform front we should know about?
Well, the big one's the icebreaker fleet.
The United States has one.
So we have one heavy icebreaker, one medium icebreaker, and that's it. We see the Arctic opening up to more and more human activity. About half of the world's reserves that are in the Arctic are actually in U.S. EEZ and are in our extended continental shelf. So we have sovereign interests up there as well. Russia will be arming ships, icebreakers, and they'll be deploying up in the high latitudes in the next several years. And right now we're not doing anything about it, at least not on the surface. And so we do have a mark this year. We've got five shipyards right now that are competing to build a fleet of icebreakers for the United States. National assets in the true sense. When you only have one heavy icebreaker, you have no self-rescue capability whatsoever. If I was the CNO of the Navy and said, you've got one aircraft carrier, don't break it, it's not enough. And so our program is to build out six icebreakers.
So despite what we hear about the Arctic melting, there's still plenty of ice to be broken through up there.
Well, I've been up there quite a bit, Tom.
And it's still cold?
Yeah, it's very cold. The wind shifts, and now you're beset in ice. We've got several cruise ships that will transit the Northwest Passage. One of our Coast Guard cutters will transit the Northwest Passage from Alaska to our shipyard in Baltimore, Maryland, this summer as well. But if the wind shifts, you know, you are now beset in ice. Russia has laid claim to most of the Arctic Ocean, you know, all the way up to the North Pole. What's our ability to challenge that? You really can't put the challenge flag down with a submarine. And we can certainly operate, our Navy can, but how do you operate surface to surface? And so these are really strategic assets in terms of our national security objectives in the Arctic. And it's good to see us, we're finally moving, getting our foot off the shore, if you will, and moving up into that area in a meaningful way by recapitalizing our ice-breaking fleet.
And I want to get back to the human capital side of the Coast Guard. You mentioned the quality of person you're seeking these days. How does recruiting generally hold up? I mean, for the rest of the armed forces, they barely make it, but they make it. How about the Coast Guard?
Yeah, we're hitting our targets, Tom. Delighted to see that. And what allows us to sustain the effort we are right now, of all the armed services, we enjoy the highest retention rate. 40% of the recruits that will come out of Cape May, New Jersey, will be on active duty 20 years from now. 60% of the officers that we commission up in New London, Connecticut, 60% will be on active duty 20 years from now. So it's one thing if you recruit, we make tremendous investments in training these individuals, but if they then leave and walk out the door, we never get to that next level where they truly become professionals at what they do, and we continue to operate with journeymen. So as long as we continue to enjoy these high retention rates, we will be well served. But I cannot assume that we're going to enjoy these unprecedented retention rates. If the economy changes, do people decide, hey, it's time for me to leave? Or Coast Guard, thank you for these great job skills. I'm not going to go make more money somewhere else. So we actually put out a human capital strategy for the 21st century to address things like dual careers and child care and the number of times we move incentive packages. And now on top of all of that, we're folding in a new retirement system, as are all the armed services. And how do we accommodate that as well? But if you don't look out for your people, you can build all these great new ships and new planes, but if you're not keeping an eye on your people, they will be tied to the pier and we will not be able to put to sea.
Yes, because the Air Force, I think, is the most visible example of what happens when you have trouble with retention, because there's an airline industry that's hungry for people, and it's pretty easy to jump ship, to make a bad metaphor here. But Coast Guard, it seems like there's more you can do by staying in the Coast Guard.
There is, and when I go out and visit field units and when I see our enlisted members in formation, the first thing I look for are their good conduct ribbons, not to see who's been naughty or nice, but each service has a distinct color code for its good conduct ribbon, and I see a lot of Navy. I see Army. I don't see too many. I'd see a few Air Force, but predominantly I see Navy, Marine, and Army good conduct ribbons in the ranks, prior service, and so they're taking sometimes 6-7 years of experience from their service, and they're jumping ship to join the Coast Guard. That's not a bad thing for me. And it's a different environment for them, but that's been an opportunity for others that still want to serve, but maybe they want to serve in a different capacity, you know, at sea in the United States Coast Guard.
Now, are you under the military pay system and military medical complex like the armed services?
We are. So our military compensation is identical. Where we are unique is that very few of our Coast Guard installations have access to a military treatment facility, a military hospital, because we are so dispersed, we become very dependent on TRICARE. And then we become very dependent on health providers that will subscribe to TRICARE. And sometimes our folks out there are challenged in terms of their ability to find quality medical care.
We're speaking with Coast Guard Commandant Admiral Paul Zukunft. And a lot of social change in society have been imposed on the military with respect to who can serve and when they can serve and in what capacities they're able to serve. Has that affected the Coast Guard, and how do you deal with some of those?
Well, Tom, I'll go back, 40 years ago when I was an ensign. That's when we integrated women into every position in the United States Coast Guard. There's not one occupation 40 years running where women cannot serve. As you know, several years ago, the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy was repealed. People have come out, and it has in no way compromised readiness, good order and discipline, and the like, people serving side by side. We're in a pause right now in terms of, transgender at our accession points, because there's more we need to know about it. This isn't about, restrooms and the like. Some of our training centers are not configured for a third gender, if you will, in terms of where do they fit or where are they in that transition. But we have certainly opened up transgender to those who have come out. And we've had very small numbers, about 8 in the entire Coast Guard since the policy was announced a little over a year ago, that have identified with a gender other than the gender of their birth. Has it compromised good order and discipline? No. Readiness? No.
And let's zoom back out to the bigger picture here. What is your overall message to, say, lawmakers, Congress, that they seem to give assent in the hearings, but then when the budget comes out, it's always the same story?
Well, it's often forgotten that we are a military service. There are 5 armed services, and we've been around a lot longer than one of them. Won't mention who it is, but those who are listening can figure out who that is, because we didn't have airplanes back in 1790. But we are not funded as a military. 96% of my budget is funded through non-defense discretionary funding. Only 4% of that is funded as a military service, and most of that is for the work that we're doing in the Mideast, where I've got a squadron of ships deployed over there. Yet we are a military service. We're law enforcement. We're the national intelligence community. And quite honestly, we enable $4.5 trillion of commerce every year in terms of what we here do domestically under our other authorities as well. And yet our net budget, pay, retirement, medical, acquisition, is less than $11 billion a year.
And you mentioned earlier use of a 50 caliber gun to fire at some of the bad guys down there in the ocean. I guess with 50 millimeter shell, they probably notice you're there. My question is there any economies of scale at all that you could enjoy sharing with the Navy or other armed services in terms of procurement?
Yeah, so right now our icebreaker program, we're actually building that in conjunction with the Navy. The appropriation is actually in the Navy's budget, not ours, so we stood up an integrated program office to build out the first of what will be a fleet of 6 icebreakers. On all of our ships, the ordnance systems, the weapon systems, the command and control systems are what we call Navy type, Navy owned. And so that allows us to operate seamlessly with the United States Navy, because we operate compatible command and control systems and weapon systems as well, funded through the Navy. And that's been a long-standing arrangement that we've had with the Navy, because at the end of the day, these are truly warships.
Anything else you want to tell me that I didn't ask?
Well, if you're listening out there, and if people say, if I had to do it all over again. So in 1973, I went off to the United States Coast Guard Academy. And I thought, well, I'll try it out for a year. And if it doesn't work out, I could always go ahead and do something else. Well, if I had the chance to do it all over again today, I'd do the exact same thing. Never thought 44 years later I'd still be wearing this uniform and serving in the Coast Guard. It's been an honor to serve. But if you're contemplating public service and military service, stop by and visit one of my Coast Guard recruiters. I'd love to have you on the team.